Coming to you live from the beating heart of Petone in New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be. You have stumbled across the Cinematica Podcast, a brand new show travelling to you across the electric ethernet. No, they don't call it the ethernet, they call it the internet, don't they now?
Intranet.
This is a 45-minute or so roundup of reviews, news and opinion about the world of cinema, helping guide you through the dense jungle of the latest cinema releases and help you get the best value out of your ever-diminishing cinema dollar. I'm Dan Slevin.
Hello, and I'm Simon Wherry.
And I'm Kaylee Carruthers.
Every week we'll be here to review all the latest releases, talk to interesting people about what they've been watching, and keep a close eye on what's happening around the world, films and stories that we're looking forward to seeing at the movies. The whole point of this exercise, because this is episode one, we should make a statement, a manifesto, if you like. The whole point of Cinematica is that we love going out to the movies. We love going to strange and interesting places to sit next to strange and interesting people in the dark and watch the glowing rectangle at the other end of the room and have stories told to us by strange and interesting people. So, in today's program, we have a very special interview with the Samoan writer and director of the film The Orator, Tusi Tamasesi. We were lucky enough to talk to him last week. His film is winning massive plaudits here in New Zealand and also several prizes at the Venice Film Festival, and is the very first New Zealand film to be in the shortlist for a Foreign Language Academy Award. What else have we got on the show today? Simon, you've been for a midnight stroll around Paris with Woody Allen in more French-type movies. Kaylee, you ended up in Monte Carlo. I stayed in France, but travelled back in time 30,000 years to the Cave of Forgotten Dreams. And we also checked out The Three Musketeers, which once upon a time was also French, but not so much anymore. So quite a lot to talk about on the program today. And to get us underway, we're going to find out what the people of New Zealand and the rest of the world have been watching at the movies. So Kaylee, you've got the New Zealand top five for us.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Dan. So, this week at the New Zealand box office, number five was Spy Kids, All the Time in the World. Number four, The Three Musketeers. Number three, Real Steel. Number two, Johnny English Reborn. And number one, The Smurfs. Just across the puddle in Australia, number five, we have The Smurfs. Number four, we have The Cup, which is a horse racing movie about a race at the Melbourne Cup.
I've read a really terrible review of that film.
Joking.
Yeah, no, a shocker. A shocker. Among the worst films that Australia has produced was that was the verdict of the review that I read. Are you getting it here?
It's early days. We'll see.
Maybe backing down. Okay, and next.
Number three, we have What's Your Number? Number two, Crazy Stupid Love. And number one, Real Steel. Now, over in North America, number five coming in is Dolphin Tale. Number four, The Ides of March. Number three, The Thing, which is not quite a sequel and not quite a remake, sort of something in between. Number two, we have Footloose, which is definitely a remake. And number one, Real Steel.
I think that you look at those statistics and you can pretty much guarantee that there will be a Real Steel 2 sometime before Christmas 2014, I would say. And how do we feel about that, team?
Bring it on, I say. Another one will be great.
That's right. You really enjoyed it, didn't you? I thought it was iffy.
I think I have not seen it yet. I think this is one of those ones that I qualify as a renter.
Can't wait to take my boy. Take the boy and go to one of those films.
Excellent.
We're bonding.
All right. Let's get into the latest films released here in New Zealand. And first of all, let's take a trip to Paris.
Why are you so dressed up?
I was just doing a little writing.
You dress up and put on cologne to write?
Because you know how I think better in the shower and I get the positive ions going in there.
I had a private detective follow him.
And what happened?
I don't know. The detective agency says the detective is missing.
Simon, you've seen Midnight in Paris. Tell us a bit about what it's about.
Well, it's a beautiful setting in Paris. They follow this kind of this family that is this American family that is staying in Paris for a holiday, and also to sort of I guess seek inspiration. There's this couple played by Owen Wilson and Rachel McAdams, who are engaged to be married and are sort of having a trip with her parents, and they go on this journey, particularly the Owen Wilson character. He goes on this journey and sort of is transported back to the good old days of Paris.
I was going to ask you a question about that, actually, because the basic premise of the film, does talking about that involve spoilers? Because I got a bit of a surprise when the magic bit happened, but at the same time, because the trailer doesn't really tell you how it's going to play out or what the idea is, you get this sense that Owen Wilson, he's a writer, he falls in love with Paris, he gets some inspiration from walking around after dark, but the trailer doesn't tell you exactly how that works. And is it supposed to be a secret?
I think it should be, yeah. I mean, I think it's very subtle in the way that you're transported, and it's very well done. And I think there should be a spoiler alert on that, because it means so much to the film, has an influence on.
Doesn't leave you with very much to talk about, though, does it?
I think there's plenty. You know, like there's a lot there. I mean, because essentially what it's about is the other side of the fence always greener. And that's in essence what the film is about.
Well, that's the argument, isn't it? Is that Owen Wilson wants to stay in Paris and write his novel. He's a successful screenwriter, hack, and his wife would rather he continue to do that sort of Hollywood hackery and make enough money so they can build their Malibu dream home. So it is that tension between following your artistic and creative dream and being all that you can be and looking after what your missus to be, who is probably pretty shallow.
She has a different set of priorities. Yeah, she does. And Owen Wilson's kind of going along for the ride, but his character's great. I mean, he kind of fills the shoes of, I guess, Woody Allen in some ways, and he exceeded my expectations. He was awesome.
I think he's really good. Every Woody Allen film has to have a Woody Allen in it, whether it's played by Woody or not. And I think that Owen Wilson's probably the best that we've had, actually. Mm. He seems to be quite a natural at that sort of stuttery cynicism that Woody Allen's perfected. And, he takes on that role. Is it funny?
Yeah, I thought it was very funny in places. I mean, I thought, you know, maybe some of the jokes were a little bit kind of in jokes, but they were, I thought they were, you know, very witty and clever. And there's this fantastic role played by Michael Sheen of this kind of academic. And we've all probably met a person like that character. And I just thought Michael Sheen is always awesome. And he was awesome in this role too. And for that alone, you know, his little cameo in the film is fantastic.
Midnight in Paris is, it's been sort of billed as Woody Allen's return to form after maybe a slow period, and I don't know if I necessarily agree with that that portrayal of the situation, because it seems to me that every film that Woody Allen puts out, somebody somewhere says, oh, this is Woody Allen's return to form. I really liked Vicky Cristina Barcelona, for example, which was his last return to form, and so I just get the feeling that that he's, you know, following his own obsessions still. You know, you'd never pretend that a Woody Allen film was made by anybody else. He's a little bit like Clint Eastwood in some ways, in that he's been around movie making for such a long period of time that it's in his blood. He wants to be on film sets, he wants to be calling action, he wants to be directing actors, and he's so good at it and his crews are so efficient. It doesn't look like it's very hard work for him anymore. He likes to be to have his feet up by about 4 o'clock every afternoon. And I think that, the world would be a poorer place without Woody Allen doing what Woody Allen does.
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, I think return to form is very, I mean, I'm sure he doesn't think he's returning to form. He's just following a path, like you say. And it's a, this is a quality film. It's got a fantastic cast. You know, they're all on you know, true to their standards. And yeah, no, I would fully endorse it. I think it's a great film.
Excellent. That's the verdict from Simon Wherry about Midnight in Paris, the Woody Allen movie. And I liked it too. And in fact, I liked it more and more the longer the film went on. And as I realized that it was rather less about Paris as such, and more about this guy's journey. So that's a recommendation from Cinematica for the first film of the day. Next, we are going to go back in time.
These images are memories of long forgotten dreams. Will we ever be able to understand the vision of the artists across such an abyss of time?
Silence, please. We're going to listen to the cave, and perhaps we can even hear our own heartbeats.
I should point out that on the other side of the room, Kaylee is absolutely paralyzed with laughter listening to that.
I absolutely loved this film. I had the chance to see it at the film festival in New Zealand here this year, and it was unintentionally hilarious. I mean, Werner Herzog has such a unique voice, and it was great. It was so entertaining.
Just to give you a little bit of an idea about what this film is about, I think the little clip of the trailer there probably creates a mood rather than tells you very much about what's been going on. 30,000 years ago, in what is now caves sort of underneath the valleys of the Ardèche in France, the first recognisably human beings started painting on the walls of their caves and making their space their own, and starting to, I guess, visually tell the stories of their lives. 30,000 years ago, it's an extraordinary amount of time. They're so precious, these pictures, that only for a couple of weeks a year are scientists and researchers allowed into the caves to actually examine them and take photographs of them and record them and study them. And a couple of years ago, Werner Herzog was allowed with a very small crew to go into those caves, and using the early sort of handheld 3D cameras, record them, so that when you at the cinema with the appropriate paraphernalia over your eyes, you can actually you actually feel like you're in the caves with these images, and you can get a magical sense of the world that would have created them, the kind of people that would have created them. I was profoundly moved. I didn't think it was unintentionally hilarious at all. For me, watching it was like an insight into the dawn of human beings and the dawn of consciousness, the dawn of spirituality, the dawn of what makes us human beings as opposed to just animals foraging for nuts and berries. And it was as if I got a sense there of some greater consciousness. You know, I'm a confirmed atheist. I don't believe in any God. But watching that film, I did feel that I was transported somehow, and I was that there was some sense of human beings transcending the earthly sphere or something. I'm not explaining it very well, but what I will say is that I absolutely adored the film, and I can't wait to see it again, actually.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it because I found it was such a mature use of 3D, because so many 3D films you see out there are kids' films or they're action films, but you know, this is using 3D imaging to really kind of bring you into this space that is not open to public, and it's a very private. You're in these huge caves, but you feel like you're kind of in this private viewing, and it's so wonderful and warm. But and Werner Herzog just always makes me laugh. It's just he's so serious and wonderful, and I just can't help but get
and he's so curious. That's another thing about Werner Herzog, is that everybody he meets he wants to find out about. And so the film itself, while it's a lot of it's about the caves, he's also just as interested in the scientists who are doing their research and where they've come from and what their stories are. And he seems to have a way of bringing people's history out of them. And you find all sorts of interesting things. One of the researchers, I think, used to be a circus performer. So, you know, it's about the wonderful breadth, width, depth of humanity. And I think Herzog's human curiosity is a thing of great wonder, and I would recommend it to everybody. I think I was transcended by it, and I hope that you will be too. So that's a thumbs up from me. And a thumbs up from you, Kaylee,
well,
I think?
No, definitely thumbs up. I really loved it. And my one piece of advice is to stick with it through to the end, because you will be richly rewarded with a really great Werner Herzog transcendental moment at the end of the film. And yes. I don't want to spoil it because it is so good.
We're the Musketeers. It's up to us to put an end to the Cardinal's plot.
I could do with some exercise.
All for one.
And one for all!
Now, what people don't realise here at Cinematica is that actually that's the bond that we share here around the Cinematica table. That's the oath that we swear before the microphones get turned on every Tuesday evening. All for one and one for all. The Three Musketeers. Kaylee, you had a fascinating experience at the movies, didn't you, with this particular film?
Absolutely. Fascinating is a great way to describe it. I watched Three Musketeers this week as a double feature with another film we'll be reviewing later, and I'll be taking over that one as well and have kind of equally interesting experience. But yeah, Three Musketeers, so it's, you know, the original French story, Three Musketeers fighting off evil, young man comes and joins them, joins in the fight, shenanigans happen, and blood is lost. Now, the original Three Musketeers was a very good film, you know, lots of action,
which
good story.
Which one do you consider to be the original? Because it goes back quite a long way.
Well, how about any version except for this?
Oh, okay.
Okay. So, I'm almost lost for words. I think it should have been a sign when I went to see this that the projector broke down and had to be restarted before the film.
So even the technology doesn't want to show it.
Even the technology didn't want to show it. I did not enjoy myself. I did not really enjoy watching the film. But the gentleman sitting behind me did. He was yelling obscenities at the screen most of the time. So there were people in the cinema who really loved it, but I couldn't get a laugh out of it, and I was really disappointed.
I'm glad somebody got their money's worth. I thought that I had a few problems with the fundamental sort of idea behind it, which is that, you know, the Three Musketeers, they're supposed to be the finest swordsmen in all France, right? And there's not much sword fighting in it for a start, and I think that it's made by P.T. Anderson. Is that right? The guy who makes the Resident Evil films, and he makes big, dumb action movies. That's what he specializes in. And this is, I think the idea is that there's going to be some kind of attempt to build a franchise off this to compete with the Pirates of the Caribbean films. But the problem with Anderson is that he isn't a good enough filmmaker to do all of the swashbuckling properly. And so he fills so much of the film with gunpowder and explosions and stuff that doesn't really fit a Three Musketeers film. So there's lots of this invented technology, airships and fantastic weaponry and such like, and it just seems like they're shoehorning a whole lot of stuff in to please a whole teenagers, basically, and to the teenage sensibility of Anderson himself. And I guess the other thing I'd say is that if I were a French person watching this film, you know, this is one of the great examples of French literature. It's a book that defines the French for themselves, and honor and heroism and all those sorts of things. And yet there's not a single French person in the entire film.
No, and everyone had a different accent. Every character had a different accent. They didn't bother.
Austrian, or Ukrainian
or American,
German or American or Poms or Danes. Mads Mikkelsen's in it, but you know they've gone everywhere except France. And so if I were a French person, I would feel a little bit hacked off, really, at how my literature had been hijacked by Hollywood and not and justice not done. Frankly,
quite right. I thought it was awful, to be honest. I was angry at the end of it because I had this vision of Michael York and all the other guys back in my day as a youth.
Oliver Reed.
And I came out of this thing and I went, I was really quite angry. And I thought, well, you know, this will tick along at the box office. It'll do some money. But it is just, they butchered it. And I was not happy.
Indeed. Wow. Mm. I don't think I've ever seen or heard you quite so forceful. That is a big no. From us for the Three Musketeers. And now it's time for the news with Kaylee.
Yes, thank you, Dan. So our top headlines today, a man in California is suing the company making responsible for The Hangover 2, saying that it stole his life story. Paramount has been rumored they are hiring writers for Top Gun 2.
And can I make another confession? I know that I tend to do this every week, but I haven't seen Top Gun 1.
Really?
Collective gasp.
How do I
seen
even
an Officer and a Gentleman?
No.
Oh, Mayo.
What was I doing? What was I doing during the 80s? I know. I was at high school. So I was a bit busy. So no. So as far as I'm concerned, Top Gun 2, yeah, I can neither here nor there. It doesn't excite me. Doesn't.
I'm looking forward to the volleyball scene. They'll have to bring that back.
It's not going to be a remake though. It's going to be a sequel. So there may not be beach volleyball.
There'll still be volleyball.
Was Val Kilmer in it?
Yep.
Yes, he was Iceman.
Right.
Have you seen him recently? He's not going to fit in the cockpit of a jet.
No, he's not going to fit in many things really. But no. Put him in a racing car. See how he fits in there.
And what else is going on in the world?
Well, Tintin has premiered in Belgium. Very exciting. And the Netherlands as well. The world critics were in attendance and there have been plenty of positive reviews. And it will be arriving in New Zealand on Boxing Day.
And I'll tell you what, New Zealand, there's a lot at stake for New Zealanders and for Wellingtonians in particular with Tintin because so much of the technical work on the film was done here in Wellington by Weta Digital. The motion capture, the actors, performances, etc., were all done in Hollywood with Steven Spielberg, but all of the animation was done here. And if the film is a success, the next one will be made here and directed by, I don't like calling him Sir Peter Jackson.
PJ. That's right.
Yeah, but it does mean that the success of Tintin would mean another significant injection of foreign exchange into the country, a country that desperately needs it at the moment.
And maybe Simon Pegg coming.
Oh, yeah, Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, yes.
My two favourite people.
Mm.
All right.
Well, present company accepted, of course.
Of course.
Of course. New Die Hard is in the works.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, and we've got a title supposedly for the film. It's due out next year, I think, and it's going to be called A Good Day to Die Hard. And I was
Tuesday.
Yeah. I follow Edgar Wright, the director of Hot Fuzz and other films like that, on Twitter, and he made a suggestion for an even better title. He suggested that it should be called Carry On Up the Die Hard, and that gets my vote too.
Yeah, and Schwarzenegger is rumored for a comeback in a Western by Ji-Woon Kim. Did I say that correctly?
I think so. Your guess is as good as mine.
Okay.
On that one?
Yes, the director of The Good, the Bad, and the Weird.
The Good, the Bad, and the Weird. This is a film that I really wished had been released here in New Zealand. It's a remake, a Korean Western mental remake of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's a Western, and yet it's Korean. It's Korean, and yet at the same time, it's a Western. It's fantastic.
So it's not a spaghetti Western. It's more of like a kimchi Western.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And it, I think this director has got enormous potential. And if anyone is going to actually justify Schwarzenegger returning to the screen in a leading role, I think that this nutcase from Korea is the one to do
it. What was your description of Schwartzy?
Oh, I read a description of him once a condom stuffed with walnuts. and on the festival front, the London Film Festival opened this week. We'll be keeping a close eye on that. Interestingly, because
our lawyers will talk to his lawyers.
A lot of the top films in the London Film Festival have already played here in the New Zealand Film Festival. It was a fantastic New Zealand festival this year. The New York Film Festival has just finished. Vancouver has just finished. Is that right, Kaylee? And also Chicago Film Festival recently finished, and they gave out their Gold Hugo Award to Aki Kaurismäki's Le Havre, which played at this year's New Zealand Film Festival. I loved it. I suspect it's not going to get a cinema release here in New Zealand, though. You know, I've often thought that, you know, the New Zealand Film Festival isn't a prize-giving festival, but I was wondering, you know, if we had a gold, if it did, what would our golden thing be here in New Zealand?
Golden kiwi?
Golden kiwi.
The golden kiwi.
Or the golden tiki.
Ooh.
I like that.
The golden tiki, golden for tiki. Best, but I think we should
use that. We should say, you know, that film's a golden tiki.
Bill, well, you know, start maybe, giving some prizes out.
Maybe next year's film festival, Cinematica can sponsor this prize.
The golden tiki.
Looking forward to the potential developments in that area. That's the news. Thank you very much, Kaylee. Last Monday, I had the pleasure of meeting the writer and director, Tusi Tamasesi, the guy who is responsible for the very first Samoan language feature film and the very first New Zealand feature film to go onto the shortlist for the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film. This is a film that is, I think, impressing everybody who sees it. It's a film about a young man who, from a chiefly family in a Samoan village, who isn't, I guess, doesn't feel that he's up to the standards that are required, and doesn't feel that he can take that chiefly place, and yet circumstances force him to stand up for himself and to stand up for his family and to stand up for his birthright, I guess. It's a film that moves people who see it, and I was very lucky to talk to Tusi Tamasesi. We also had a Q&A session here at the cinema after the Monday night screening, so we'll have some extract from that Q&A a little bit later on. But first of all, I asked Mr. Tamasesi how he, where he realised, and how he realised that a filmmaking career was for him.
I guess it was when I came to when I did studies up in Waikato, and just coming across the calendar where it says film studies. I always loved films, but I never knew that you had to study. So when I did that, it was like a lucky, you know, you're trying to grab a dream. But behind my, you know, the back of my head, I still knew that I wasn't quite sure. I took the course because I loved it. I love films. But I wasn't sure what I was gonna do or how I was gonna end up. But when I left Waikato and came down and went to the film school, I did the same. I just went to, you know, try to get some more skills. But just before the course finished, I wrote a short screenplay, which I gave to my lecturer, and she said she liked it, and I've never written anything before. So,
well, and you said that you already loved films before you went to Waikato, before you saw that entry in the calendar. What were the films that made you fall in love with cinema as a medium, and did you watch them in cinemas or were you watching on videos at home?
Mostly videos. When I grew up, you know, at high school, I began to snuck away into the cinemas. But when I was growing up, I was very fortunate that I had many brothers and sisters, and they all had different tastes in film. And then you had the mainstream Hollywood stuff like Steven Spielberg and his films, and then you have the Kung Fu ones with the Chinese with my other brother loved. And then you have the serious art house films and horrors. So I wasn't allowed to pick videos at the time, but my older brothers brought videos home, so I watched the whole lot of them. I think that's where I began to love films. But at the back of it, it's the storytelling and the kind of characters that that I really picked up on. Mostly Kurosawa stuff. What else? Spielberg, Lucas.
Kurosawa, Spielberg, and Lucas, all people who make their films on a very big canvas. Your first film is about very big themes, but it's painted on quite a modest canvas, a small village in a small island. Tell me where you got the idea from for The Orator.
I was fascinated by a few things, especially growing up in Samoa. How people, the relationship and the bond between the living and the loved ones, and I wanted to write something about that. And I also wanted to write something about the power of a chief. What makes a chief, I've had a few drafts, but it wasn't quite tying up with what I wanted. And I guess when I started to I looked at the image of a chief, and I started to strip that away, and I found my character there. I found my main character there, and it sort of tied up everything that I wanted to. It tied up the culture. In Samoa, you have the ideal chief or Matai is someone who's a big person, and the metaphor is that with a small person, versus a bigger person, it stands out in the culture. Not only you've never seen a small person as a chief.
Your central character in The Orator is somebody who takes a long time to discover their own voice, a long time to realize their own potential, and in some ways they need to be pushed forward. They have to hit rock bottom, don't they, before they will really embrace their destiny. Do you feel like there's a metaphor there for your own career and how hard you had to work to be taken seriously as a director?
Yeah, I guess I had to prove that that I had the skills to make the film. But what I felt confident in was that my vision. Mm. I knew what I wanted would be different. And similarities there. I had to go through a lot of stuff. Trying to get into the industry and but I was very fortunate that I had people there that were joining me on the journey and just pushing me along and the motivation that got through, yeah.
And for Samoa, for the people of Samoa, to have a feature film made not just with them as a backdrop or as a location, but for them as the subject matter, how did they take to that when you arrived with your crew?
People were supportive, and I guess anything about portraying Samoans or portraying the culture or the land people are a bit suspicious. It came down to explaining the themes and explaining that the film wasn't trying to cast a shadow or cast something bad on the island. It's trying to expose not only the goodness of the culture and the people and the beauty of the land, but also to show the faults, which I didn't tell them.
But you didn't.
I told him in a different way.
Because that's one of the aspects of the film that I found most striking when I saw it, was that you are able to present an aspect of the Samoan culture in terms of how disputes are dealt with. On one side, they're dealt with through oratory and poetry and a very formal, meticulous arrangement in the meeting grounds, and then on the other side there's stones thrown and threats of machetes, and it seems like there may not be very much going on in the middle of those two extremes.
I wanted to showcase that in Samoa, to deal with conflict, you have archery, it's dealt with, and things are calmed with words. But I also wanted to showcase the faults of human beings, where we, the violence and how words versus violence, and it's a little bit deep in the film, because when I wrote the thing, I wanted to showcase that that people with no respect, I guess, would result to violence, and it takes a calm person to control his anger and all that, and use words to resolve.
Now, this is the first time that I've met you, Tusi, and you are very polite and very soft-spoken and quite a reserved character. How do you become the boss on a movie set? Doesn't the director have to be a tyrant?
No, I think just because the relationship we sort of established with the crew was important, because we shot the short film, my short film, before, and I developed a really close relationship with the crew members, and they all knew how who I was and how I was like, and so they were very patient and calm. But I guess it's you sort of get into a zone where you just consumed by what you have to get, and just being, I think, being polite and being appreciative of the efforts that your crew bring gets you a long way if you're quiet.
And a little bit stubborn as well, I suppose.
Oh, slightly.
The lovely, soft-spoken Tusi Tamasisi, the writer and director of The Orator, which is impressing people all over New Zealand and doing excellent business, and I'm sure we'll be travelling the world soon rather than later. After the screening on Monday night, we had a Q&A, a live Q&A featuring Tusi and also the producer of the film, Catherine Fitzgerald, and the editor, Simon Price, and we were lucky enough to have an excellent audience and some excellent questions. My first question was to Catherine, though, was about the process of actually getting the film developed and getting it in front of a camera in the first place.
Well, I guess Tusi and I had very, 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 very beginnings of a germinating conversation at the end of 2006, before he wrote the script at the screenwriting course at Vic. I first read the script in the beginning of 2008. So by many standards, this has gone quite quickly, However, it didn't feel like that as we were struggling away against the odds trying to get it up. I have to say that a lot of people, I wasn't the only person who loved the script and thought it was original and different. But equally, there are people who, when you've got something, I guess the distributor summed it up when the first time he read the script, he said the very best and the very worst thing about this is there's nothing else like it. You can't say it's Real Steel meets Magnolia. you know, there's no way you could do that. He said, so that makes it a marketing challenge and a marketing dream. So we continue to be forging new ground. You know, it's not something that's been done before. All the way through, every way we've done this film, it's not the way most people do it. Our development process was different. We basically, most people put all their energy into developing the script before they go anywhere. We put most of our energy into proving that we could make it, that Tusi could direct it, that I would be able to produce something in Samoa. So instead of spending our money on, well, Tusi being able to spend his money on living, we used the development money we got in the loans to make a short film and go out there and show that it could be done.
That's the producer of the orator, Catherine Fitzgerald, at the special Lighthouse Cinema Q&A last Monday night. We had an excellent question from the audience during that Q&A about the pace of the film, because it is a very unusual film in this day and age. There are lots of long takes. The story takes its own sweet time to unfold. And that was a question that was exceedingly well answered by the editor of the film, Simon Price.
Yeah, I think when I first came on the project, one of the things I noticed about the script, because I did the same course as Tusi in the script writing course, and that there was a great pace in the words already, in the actual scenes, the way he'd laid them out. So when I came on as the editor, I tried to maintain and be true to that as well, because obviously it is the world and there's truth in that. But we talked a lot about art house kind of pace and long takes and slow things, but also really trying to maintain that electricity. Like the film was allowed to stretch and be long, but as long as that electricity lay underneath, which I think one of the very clever things that these two people did was bring me over to Samoa so I could have an experience of the actual place as opposed to my preconceptions as a Palangi New Zealander. And that was very important in terms of the conversation that Tusi and I had in the edit suite when we got back to Wellington, and we were cutting over the course of about 6 months at the start of this year. But yeah, just keeping that sense of electricity lying underneath the extended pace, but being brave enough to hold. Really, the dialogue editor, Chris Todd, I remember he said at the end of the edit, as we were heading into the fine cut, don't you dare cut any of that pace out. You know, too many films get to this point and then they just rip it out. And you're like, oh, we're never going to. But, you know, I think, yeah, it's great. I'm really proud that we managed to keep it in there and maintain the length that we did.
That's Simon Price, the editor of The Orator, at the exclusive Lighthouse Cinema Q&A for The Orator last Monday night. And The Orator's playing all over New Zealand, and as I say, will, I expect, get to cinemas all over the world in the fullness of time. Certainly if it gets picked up as an Academy Award nominee for foreign language film, then that'll make sure that it gets out to cinemas all over the world. And yeah, we all recommend it here, don't we?
Absolutely. I thought, and that they were just superb. They were just so charming and so sort of dedicated to that, to their work. It was a real treat to sort of meet them and talk like that.
Exactly. Yep. We had a lovely time talking to them. So next up, we're going to start talking about newspapers.
I knew there was only one way to get Kirk out of Mormonism, and that was to make love with him. Kirk and I went to this cottage. We made love for 3 days. It was like a honeymoon.
That cackle belongs to the amazing character Joyce McKinney, who, and I remember this from my childhood. I grew up in England, and so this story was around my consciousness as a sort of 9 and 10 year old. I think it may even have been the first time I saw a naked woman on the front page of a English newspaper, so probably quite a transcendent moment for me there. Joyce McKinney was a woman who was absolutely obsessed with her first real boyfriend, who was a serious committed Mormon, and his church advised him that she wasn't the kind of person that he should be hanging out with, and so he disappeared and went to be a missionary in the UK in about 1976-77. She, with the help of private detectives and such like, found out where he was, flew over to England with bodyguards and a private pilot and all sorts of strangeness, and kidnapped him, took him away to a cottage in Devon, and tried to win him back from his Mormon faith through her physical prowess. Yes, indeed. After 3 days, he said, I'd better go back and tell them that I'm not going to be a Mormon missionary anymore. And then he was either, depending on who you talk to, he was either wooed back by the missionaries, by the Mormons, and told that he had done a very, very bad thing and he was going to have to spend the rest of his life atoning for it, or he was brainwashed, depending on who you talk to. This story, interesting though it is, I don't know if it really deserves a feature film. This, I spent the whole time watching, and this is a film made by Errol Morris, who has made films about Abu Ghraib, and he's managed to free prisoners who are on death row, and exposed the truth of the Vietnam War, and his interview technique gets the truth out of people, gets people's real characters emerge from his extended interviews. And I was watching this and going, really? Is this story worth all of the effort that you're going to for it? Kaylee, you've seen it. What did you think?
This was actually one of the highlights of the New Zealand Film Festival for me this year. I really enjoyed it. Now, and yes, Errol Morris is a fantastic documentarian, and I went through university watching all his work as, you know, of examples of great documentary work, and, you know, his kind of pioneering of his interview methods and the way he does reenactments in documentaries, especially with The Thin Blue Line, I believe it is. But, you know, he's also done some kind of fluffier documentaries. He did Gates of Heaven, which is about Pet Sematary owners interviewing, you know, things like that, which is quite good. So I found this one was kind of Errol Morris having a bit of fun with this documentary. And but he has that way of finding these really quirky characters and just getting these really interesting stories out of them. And I think in this one, he's not worried about getting the truth. It's about entertainment. And it's a movie called Tabloid that's about kind of being tabloid itself. It's just kind of entertaining. He's found this really quirky woman, and it's going to be a great ride.
I thought she was a little bit sad, actually. And it seemed to me that there was not a huge amount of difference from the exploitation, I guess, of this woman's eccentricities by Errol Morris, and therefore by us as an audience, and the way she was treated by the British tabloid press back when the story was happening. It seemed to me that we were complicit in the same thing happening all over again, it seemed to me. But she's a fascinating character. It is an interesting story, and there's something, it's like a bit of a car crash, really, and you know, but at the same time, yeah, I can't really recommend it, but you can?
I can recommend it, but I think, you know, as a mixed review here at Cinematica, go see it for yourself.
First class.
We are way out of our league.
This was never part of the plan. I'm out.
Real Cordelia gets to play hooky for a few days.
And we all get the vacation that we deserve.
Kaylee, you went to Monte Carlo, didn't you? And you didn't invite us. Well, actually, you did invite me because I was there with you. But you can start talking about this. I hesitate before actually even calling it a film.
You didn't invite me.
Well, Dan got me in with his VIP pass, so.
Nice work.
Yes. Yes, so Monte Carlo, a tween film, I guess you could call it, about a case of mistaken identity. Justin Bieber's girlfriend shows up in France to do a tour right before she goes off to university, gets mistaken for a very wealthy heiress, and ends up traveling to...
Is she Justin Bieber's girlfriend?
She's Justin Bieber's girlfriend, yes.
Well, his real girlfriend.
Yes, in real life.
In real life.
Wow. Justin Bieber isn't in this movie.
I've got a fever for the Bieber. He's not in there.
No, he's not. Sorry.
Okay. See, I was looking at her thinking, you know, somebody is going to stick her and that guy, Taylor Lautner from Twilight, in a movie together, and then they can both not be able to act together.
Didn't that happen recently? Hasn't he been in a film?
He's in a film called Abduction at the moment, which is also extremely disappointing because there is not a single abduction in it. So completely misleading. Anyway, sorry. Back to Monte Carlo.
Yeah, so Monte Carlo, case of mistaken identity, hijinks ensue, and you will be bored out of your tree.
Yes, indeed. Certainly you will be bored if you're not completely insulted by it. Maybe both. I was both. It's the values that this particular film is espousing to its audience are so corrupt and so foul that it almost rendered me speechless. It's like an advertisement for the joys of misogyny, because, you know, in this, like Sex in the City, you just come out going, is that what women are like? Really? Then I'm going to go to the pub and watch footy with my mates. And that's what this film is like. If I was a teenage boy looking at a film like this, I'd be going, how am I ever going to be able to talk to these women? Because they've got nothing interesting to say and are not interested in anything interesting apart from, well, they're not interested in anything interesting. Shoes would appear, mostly. Am I right? Or set me straight, Kaylee, because you are a person of the female persuasion, so you can tell me whether I've gone off the deep end here.
Yes, well, being the one female representative of Cinematica, and, you know, I was bored, and there was no, as you said, no values. There's absolutely no moral to the story at all, and it was just about...
Vapid
nothingness.
But how is a young 12-year-old young lady going to find it? Like, what's the market?
The market is 12, 13, 14 year old girls.
So how are they going to find it?
Kaylee, we all look at you.
See, and I was thinking when I came out, I was like, you know, if I was in that age group, would I go see this movie? And honestly, I don't think I would. If I was a fan of Selena Gomez, who's the lead, and she's a Disney bopper, you know, she's been in their TV shows and I think a couple movies, so there's already that built up fan base, so I'm guessing it'll be kind of that group who goes and sees it, and maybe they'll like it, maybe they'll want to go to France and meet up with random Australian rugby players and go on whirlwind romances, and
maybe their dreams will come true, or maybe they'll just be given a completely false idea about what's important in the world.
Touche.
So what's...
You were so wrong. Michael Caine used to talk like this.
It's not quite nasal enough the way you're doing it.
When it gets loudly, it gets very loud indeed.
And you don't do the broken voice.
But it gets very emotional.
Cheers.
Taste of a childhood garden.
Was there a lot of alcohol in your garden as a child? I'm sorry, Rob.
They always say something like, gentlemen to bed before we leave at first light.
No, they never leave at
9:30. Gentlemen to bed, for we leave at 9:30-ish.
The trailer alone for this film is a joy. This is The Trip, Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon's rites of passage journey around the north of England and the fine French restaurants of the north of England.
A consummation of comedy, if you will.
Oh, nice. A consommé of comedy.
Wow.
I can't talk about the feature film version of this because I haven't seen that. I've seen the BBC television series that the feature film is cut down from. So that was 6 half-hour episodes, and I watched it all in one night. It was like watching a long film with a few breaks for cups of tea in the middle. But I thought it was absolutely magnificent, a sensational achievement, and apart from the comedy, which we got a sense from the trailer there, that what a wonderfully funny film it is. I didn't realise how moving it was going to be, and how sad both of those two characters were going to be. Does the feature film version lose anything, do you think?
Well, you see, it's funny you say that, because I hadn't seen the series. I just heard about it, you know, a few months ago and knew that it was one to line up and check out, and I didn't know that there was this amazing sort of TV series, and so when I went to it, you know, I didn't know really what to expect, and it was just this incredible roller coaster of these two guys bouncing off each other, you know, and just being very competitive with each other. But then also, like you say, in the background there is this kind of slight sadness to it, which, you know, spoiler alert, you know, you don't want to go on too much about that, but it is, I thought, you know, one of the better films I've seen this year. It was very funny, and these guys just hit it out of the park. They're just awesome.
They are, and I think it's incredibly brave of both of them to be playing characters that are them and yet not them at the same time, and it will be so easy for people to think, well, this is what it must be like to be Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon, and yet it can't possibly be.
But
really,
which bits, you know, you're watching it and you're going, which bits is this them, is this not, you know, which bits are it? It's interesting.
I know, and it's a film that I consider to be a keeper, you know, like I think that you watch it in the cinema, particularly if you're going to get to see this with a big audience where lots of people are laughing, the waves of laughter going backwards and forwards across the cinema, I think that you're going to have an absolutely magnificent time. But I also think that it's one of those that is going to be worth going back to again and again. And I think you'll continue to get subtleties out of it that may not necessarily be apparent first time round. Kaylee, what did you think?
I found it really funny, and I haven't seen the TV show either, but I've been listening to clips of them, you know, their impression offs, if you will. And no matter how many times you hear the Michael Caine war, it is never unfunny. Like, it is just too good.
And they're not the best impressions either. No, those Michael Caine ones are not the best ones.
I went home and practiced after that. When I saw it, I went home, you know, and for a week I was driving my wife nuts trying to just get it right.
The best impression in the entire... I hope that this is actually in the feature film. Maybe it's not. I hope it is. But that is Steve Coogan's Liam Neeson impression is so spot on that it's absolutely uncanny. And I mean, the whole film has joys all the way through it, it's probably the film of the week, really.
Yep.
For us, isn't it?
Absolutely, that's the one.
And if the comedy doesn't take you, then the beautiful scenery of the wintry northern England will.
Oh, and the food, let's not forget the food.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
That's the end of episode one of this season of the Cinematica podcast. I've been your host, Dan Slevin, and with me in the studio has been Simon Wherry and Kaylee Carruthers. Thank you very much for your time and your effort. You can find out more about the Cinematica podcast at cinematica.co.nz, where you'll be able to track down previous and future episodes of the show. You can join in the conversation on Twitter using the hashtag Cinematica or the @CinematicaCast username. That's us. You can communicate with us. You can also find our Facebook page and leave messages for us via the website as well. Give us your feedback, because we would love to hear your opinions about the show. And also, at the iTunes store, leave us a good review, give us a good rating as well, because that helps us push us up to the top of the charts and gets more people listening to the show. And that's what we're here for, really, to get the message of a love of cinema out as far as we possibly can. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you again same time next week here on the Cinematica podcast.